Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. My name is Geert, and I am very happy to announce today's guest, Dr. Willem de Lint. Welcome to you, Willem.
Thanks. Welcome. thank you, Geert. Nice to good to be here.
Yeah, great pleasure. Willem holds a PhD in criminology from the University of Toronto, and until recently worked as a professor in criminal justice at Flinders University in South Australia. And he's now an independent researcher. Recent projects of his include studies on counterterrorism prosecutions, blended justice and interagency collaborations, also intelligence-led policing and public order policing. And today we will be discussing his 2021 book, Blurring Intelligence Crime, A Critical Forensics, which was published by Springer. Willem, first of all, we do have a somewhat academic audience. I think you describe as you're an independent author and researcher. How does that work? Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, I mean, it works in the sense that most of what I've done under the auspices of working for a university has been to sort of follow my nose into, you know, where it leads me. And so to the degree that that's been mutually constructive and beneficial, that has been good. But now I think in the age of a much more, I think, corporatized and risk-averse university environment, sometimes I think independent research or in some sense it's pure research can suffer under the auspices of a university. And so I'm quite happy now to be independent and to feel free to sort of express myself without sort of fear of operating at the displeasure of the university.
I think that might relate to the topic of the book as well, at least tangentially. Maybe if I may try and summarize the theme of the book, it's about the interpretation of big security related events and then how the framing of these events interacts with political interests. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah, I think that one of the things about crime, and I am fascinated by particularly these big crimes that appear to be in front of us, but not necessarily that well analyzed or that fully analyzed by criminologists. And I think part of the reason is that because once these events become very significant political crimes, they also are problems of interpretation for a lot of people, not only for experts, but also for lay people. And it's not surprising that that's the case because they may involve national security actors and actions. And this creates a problem of interpretation and forensics in particular. So I thought it would be interesting to look at some cases. And of course, the selection of cases is always going to be a problem, but, you know, you have to make some kind of choices with respect to selection. So I just tried to figure out a group of cases that would be interesting for analysis to some degree, and to try to figure out a way of doing that analysis that I suppose highlights more of the critical interpretation over the, I suppose some people would refer it as a sort of a liberal interpretation of events, which more or less takes as a given that what government authorities say about something that government authorities have the most information on must be more or less true. And so these events, unless they're events that are claimed by other government authorities, in other words, government authorities that are not that are opposite of us or other than us. And so this has to do with the bifurcation, I suppose, of these big events, and the bifurcation of these big events by geopolitics. And so, you know, geopolitics isn't a very big question for most criminologists. And so the relationship between the geopolitical and the criminological is something that you don't find very much in much of criminology. And so that's really what I've been trying to look at and try to explore it a little bit. Not only, you know, why is it that these events are not so much explored, but then if you were to explore it, what are some ways of exploring it without taking too many assumptions for granted? And I think a lot of I suppose when I look at intelligence, I see too much of it is dominated by, I suppose I would call it a liberal perspective. And then if you do see a more of a radical perspective, it tends to be more in the popular literature as opposed to the academic literature. In the popular literature, you can get what otherwise might be considered a radical perspective, but not so much in the academic literature. I'm not sure if that was the answer to the question, but that's sort of what...
Definitely. I think we'll get into some of those, what you mentioned, or what you call big crimes later. At the start of the book, however, you really start from what I would call like a plane that I, as a criminologist, I recognize, so to say, namely, it's about forensics and the... Just the maybe it's also recognizable for any empirical scientist, so to say, the problems of the gathering of data and trying to describe a scene. Why first of all, at the start of the book you ask the question. It's very epistemological. You ask, how do we know crime? What are the main challenges with epistemology of crime?
Yeah. And so one of the first things is standpoint. So, you know, we have authorities that maybe come to a crime scene, but first they have to be designated. First, we have to understand something as a possible crime scene. And so now in most crimes, it's not a big problem, but in crimes that may involve politics, in particular big politics or big political actors, it does become a problem. Because then it may involve some very strong national security interests. And so then the authority of the investigator becomes an issue. At least it becomes an issue depending on, you know, who may be the culprit in the crime. For example, in the Rainbow Warrior case, that case would not have been known to people, to a lay audience, or to a great majority of New Zealanders, certainly at the time, if it weren't for some, you know, pretty straightforward criminal or investigation by police. And then what makes it a bit unusual is that these investigations were proceeding without any kind of really real interference from any higher levels of authority.
Maybe we can start with a description of the Rainbow Warrior event, so to say.
Yeah. So what happened is that there was a during the 1980s, New Zealand was had a nuclear free zone, 200-mile restriction zone for nuclear subs. It had a pretty strong policy about that. There were no nuclear submarines allowed within its territorial waters. And in the meantime, France was doing testing, testing of nuclear devices, you know, in the Pacific atolls. And so Greenpeace was going to make, make a show about this and send its Rainbow Warrior ship out to the atolls and record what was going on, by the French. And so what the French did was they sent 12 of their agents to New Zealand to bomb the Rainbow Warrior in Auckland Harbor, which they succeeded in doing. And during that, a photographer was killed. He was on the boat and he was killed. And so it was not only it was a terrorist act. And in fact, ironically, France, you know, originally described the act as a terrorist act, when they were saying that they had nothing to do with it. Unfortunately, that the investigation, what happened is that when you send a lot of French, people, highly educated people, to the northern part of the tip of New Zealand, and they're sort of having a good time in a sort of a James Bond way of womanizing, and all their way down to Auckland, they may be noticed. And in fact, they were noticed by several people, several different types of people. And what happened was their investigation was started. And by the time that the ship was blown up, so many different parts of information were available, became available to the New Zealand police, that they were able to finger the two of the people involved and charge them with manslaughter. And they did, and they were charged, and they were convicted. And so the thing about that is that normally an investigation that involves a murder involves a lot of the things that happened in this case in New Zealand. But in other cases where national security actors may be involved, there are efforts made to suppress information. There was an investigation done in France, or a couple of inquiries done in France, of their involvement in this case. And this, the first investigation attempted to absolve the Mitterrand government, say it was a rogue element within the government, not certainly with the at the highest level of the government. And that kind of fell apart. And so it really became a very unseemly spectacle for France. It's not that they did it, but it's that they were caught. I think that was the problem with what happened. In a sense, the mission was successful. It had collateral damage. In fact, one of the actors involved, one of the agents involved, said, "Well, you know, it was something that we do. I'm not sort of embarrassed about or ashamed of it. I wouldn't say I wouldn't do it again, because that is the kind of activities that are sometimes necessary to do by the state." Even if they do, offer risks of so-called collateral damage. And so, yeah, so the forensics in this case worked quite well. And the now the outcome of it is not necessarily that the people that should be punished get punished, because in these big crimes, that rarely is the case. The people that ought to be punished rarely get punished in big crimes. It's almost the opposite. If you looked at some of these big crimes, I mean, it would be very rare. Now, Epstein is an example where you have a person who has been punished, but of course we don't exactly know what is behind that whole affair. But anyway, with the forensics there, you know, it worked quite well. The political involvement of the French was such that they couldn't really do much about it, because they were at loggerheads with New Zealand with respect to their policy their nuclear policy. So they weren't going to get a lot of friendship out of New Zealand at that time. So they weren't able to put wraps on it. And the other thing that's interesting about that too is, you know, and it's a bit of a question, you know, the degree to which the Nine Eyes would have been sharing information, or, you know, are they, or is there a real strong compartmentalization there? Typically what happens is that you don't have these operations go on your sister party. I mean, that seems like a very provocative of things to do. If you're supposed to be friends in intelligence, what are you doing going around in the backyard of your sister or brother agency and causing that kind of mischief? That doesn't seem like you know, this civilized behavior of the intelligence, you know, brotherhood or sisterhood. Nevertheless, it occurred.
It's an intriguing example, perhaps because in this case, what the stately actor tried to accomplish, the way the stately actor tried to frame the crime didn't work out, right?
No, it didn't.
Do you have an example where it did work out?
Well, I mean, you know, with like, for instance, in with Raymond Davis, I mean, I think we've all forgotten about him, right? And he was a contractor, a CIA contractor, and he was in, in Pakistan, and you know, he may well have been doing some reconnaissance or information gathering to determine, you know, who needs to be on the hit list, at least according to some of the investigative journalists that were there. And so he ended up.
Are we talking Willem?
Pardon?
Which era are we talking, Willem?
Oh, this is in the 2000s. This is a different era. This was during the sort of the height of the drone campaign, or just around the drone campaign under Obama. There were a lot of people that were being targeted through in this drone campaign. And the Pakistanis, there were motorcyclists, Fazin Haider and Fahim Shamshad, and they were shot by Raymond Davis at a red traffic light. And then he stepped out of his car and shot them through the windshield to finish them off, apparently. And a third man was run over when the U.S. consulate, someone from the U.S. consulate came running to the scene to help Davis out. So that happened almost immediately because he was there exposed to the problematic, you know, Pakistani mob, presumably. But Davis' story, you know, he needed to change his story because he first said these people were trying to rob him. But then he said they were Pakistani spies, you know, and so they did have a, you know, a cover story at the beginning, but he was not on the list of diplomats that the U.S. gave to Pakistan, but he was a CIA contractor, you know. So he was arrested and charged, and he faced, the Lahore High Court. But then a Sharia court was hastily, you know, composed instead so that the U.S. could offer the families of the victims blood money for his release, right? So that worked out really quite well because, you know, I mean, he ended up being able to be removed back to the United States. And, you know, information was protected. Pakistan, you know, was on side through this in the sense that they allowed that Sharia court to be struck instead of something else happening with Raymond Davis. And so that was a nice mutually beneficial compromise for that. Still a little bit better, you know, because Pakistan, you know, is still, you know, in a different kind of relationship or it was in a different relationship with the United States, I guess, at the time. Than New Zealand was with France at the time of that other crime. So it doesn't matter. The geopolitical relationships matter a great deal, and they do influence. So of course, the argument for most people is that no, when there's a crime, there's a rule of law, and the rule of law asserts itself, and the real rule of law is blind, and justice is blind. We expect, and people, lay people, know that when it comes to very, very significant political events, the rule of law is anything but blind. People don't even expect it to be blind, but that's where the sort of expert criminology or expert discourse or liberal discourse and the popular discourse part company.
Oh, sorry. So this is when we talk about the rule of law parts, say, and how the judicial system deals with these situations. Maybe one step before that, I think it's in chapter two, you say that the vast majority of actors will avoid generating findings that do not accord with the worldview of political leadership. And I guess maybe there's some kind of heuristic for the forensic agent proper, even before any legal affairs are involved. Reflect a bit on their role.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think a lot of, like, I was looking at some of the sort of forensic literature, this idea of bias and how it might be formed and the different ways it's formed. Because oftentimes, even before you're on a scene or even before you're asked to review some evidence, you may already, and it's very difficult not to, you may already have some presuppositions. So science, like justice, is supposed to be somewhat blind in that respect. However, for instance, in a crime scene, you may not know, you may have no idea, who the perpetrator is. And so you want to have some kind of angle on an investigation in order to determine what's to be tested, what's to be looked at, what's to be reviewed, what's to be analyzed. And so not having any capacity to be instructed with respect to what needs to be looked at or reviewed or analyzed or would make life pretty difficult in some cases for forensic analysts and so it's not that there can't be any kind of handover which involves a little bit of information, which may be in that respect too much information with respect to heuristic viewpoint. It's an inevitability. Now, there's a lot of mechanisms that are designed to overcome that, right? And so, you have these mechanisms that are designed to overcome it to a large degree, and they do overcome it. But the interesting thing is when they are those mechanisms that you normally use are not necessarily followed. And so the prediction is that there will be novel mechanisms or novel ways of doing some forensic analysis when the interest is much stronger politically. So if there's a really strong interest politically, then you might see more likely to have some innovation in some forensic technique or application, because of the desire to discover a result so the entire community wants you to discover. So that's where it becomes interesting. We don't know, what the facts are about some of these events, but we can say that, well, there's some unique applications that may be, that may have arisen, and the spread of those unique applications arising is really where the political is more prominent. And so you're not going to find very many novel, inventions as much where you know, where the interest is much less, I think, is the idea. And so I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems likely because people are trying, as you were mentioning before, to find a way of fitting a most convenient narrative, a most convenient result with the tools or that are in play, and if those tools aren't sufficient, then trying to sort of manufacture some little bit of a twist on those tools in order to get that result. But this has to do with the idea that we like to, and this is when I use the term we like to believe that we are basically just people working in a just world, all involved in just outcome using the rule of law. Yes, that's the case for most crimes, I suppose. But wherever there's a great deal of political interest, that becomes less and less the case, and that's where the deviations are more likely to occur. The OPCW, Aaron Mate has written about that, and a few other investigative journalists have looked at that. But on the OPCW, with respect to the bombing in Douma, I think it's interesting how with the case of the OPCW, that politics is a thing, I think, for, at least for some of us, a little bit more obvious. if we're willing to accept what Aaron Mate and what the whistleblowers, the OPCW whistleblowers, have said, if we're willing to accept that, then we're seeing a straightforward politicization. And I also make reference to to John Bolton's visit to the OPCW director. I think it was in if I'm not mistaken, it was in The Hague where he made that visit. But in any case, that was was prominent in the news at the time, but conveniently forgotten. And of course, the OPCW director was replaced a few months later. And this is what the United States wanted. And so, yes, there is obviously a lot of pressure on making these instruments. These are forensic instruments. The OPCW is a forensic instruments, and there's a lot of pressure on making those forensic instruments accord with a rule of a rules-based order, which is dominated by, I guess, the United States in this case.
Yeah, all those tools, just as well, really technical tools. They're never neutral in the epistemological sense. I guess.
Yeah, and I think I did a little reading of Foucault in that respect, because I think he's really interesting in the sense that knowledge is power, power is knowledge, and these are very intertwined terms. So the discourse is framed or informed by power knowledge, and it's the intersection of power knowledge, that's the way that power can't divorce itself in any fundamental way from knowledge, that's key. Right now, you can't take that too far, right? Obviously. But it's certainly informative. These institutional, setting for forensics is important. Like, so miscarriages of justice is a very well-known field of inquiry with respect to forensic, malfeasance or whatever you. And so a lot of people look at more petty, straightforward crimes in terms of particularly murders, and they look at where the mistakes were. By the police and by forensics, or how forensic agencies were captured by law enforcement. There have been some very notorious cases in that respect. But they also include like the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, and those are interesting because they again are not only cases of political assassination or alleged political assassination, but the application of a miscarriage of justice narrative.
Could you briefly illustrate those cases?
I just mentioned them more or less in passing, but these are cases where The British authorities very quickly came to conclusions with respect to two sets of terrorist IRA terrorist cases, and their the methods that they used to develop their suspects turned out to be very poor indeed, and so they required the British government to look into how these kinds of cases are developed and whether they need another body to review, a prosecution's review committee to be in place, because they can't really trust that there isn't anything systemic. So there is likely to be something systemic. The smaller the cohort of actors that are ultimately involved in very key decision making, and this is another problem when national security comes into play, because you do end up with smaller and smaller numbers of people that are involved in key decision making or significant key decision-making, also decision-making that may not be reviewed in a way that we typically think that needs to be reviewed. And that goes into the whole idea of how intelligence is reviewed or overseen by the government and the interest in that, which is not very big, because it tends to be the graveyard of politicians. The scrutiny of intelligence tends to be a way of getting yourself into trouble as a politician. As Frank Church, I suppose, discovered.
I see. So, in a certain sense, you would say that the more eyes, the better, when it comes to the more significant forensic cases.
Yeah, I think most people would. You have to have, and so the labs themselves. There are ways of auditing labs, and there's a whole robust. Discussion about how that can be done, and there are a lot of people in the forensic community that have developed a lot of very good expertise on how that ought to be done, and it is, I suppose, still we have this problem of agency capture that also applies in labs, and so. I think it's possible to make too much out of the exception to the case, where most cases are, uncontroversial. So there is a possibility of making too much of the exception of the case. But we've seen some very notorious miscarriages of justice involving these involving forensic labs in the past.
So in chapter four, you I think it's called Apex Crime. Yeah, Apex Crime, the events of September 11th. So you indicate that temporarily, which might also be logical in such a big event, but many forensics related procedures were not followed. Is that the main marker for say a critical criminologist?
Yeah, I think so. Like in terms of like I said before, what would you expect if there's an interest in finding a resolution? Everybody remembers everybody at a certain age anyway remembers the 9/11, and it's quite interesting in many respects. I mean, in one respect, of course, the perpetrators were named, within, I suppose, a matter of hours, or at least in a day or two after the event. This, despite the idea that there's a collapse of intelligence and a collapse of intelligence imagination, as per the 9/11 Commission. Normally what you have is you have a crime scene and you need to discover, who did it. And you need to do that with some objectivity. In this case, in a lot of cases, in the 9/11 case, some of these sites, they weren't, One of the things, and this is, a lot of people won't like the example, but you know, they weren't looking for evidence of explosives in New York, you know, and you know, I mean, for a lot of people, when you don't know what happened, you need to, you know, consider all possibilities, especially when the possibility of explosive is consistent with other parts of evidence. And so there's certainly enough evidence to suggest that there's possibility of explosives, but that idea was never investigated, that there could be explosions might have caused the collapse of the Twin Towers. I mean, you know, I don't think it's that outrageous to consider that, but it wasn't something that was considered. And so then you follow all the other. So then basically what happens is that the narrative, the possibility, the possible suspects for a crime gets narrowed at the beginning. And this is what happened in 9/11. The possible array of suspects gets narrowed at the beginning. With the financial investigation, you know, once it was determined that that Bin Laden didn't have, you know, wasn't the Bin Laden network, Al Qaeda network wasn't being didn't get support from the whatever kind of financial irregularities were taking place, then that was the end of that investigation. So okay. You know, nothing further there because the suspect has already been understood to be Al Qaeda and Bin Laden. So, you know, who else do we need to investigate in terms of those financial irregularities? Well, that's kind of an example of where, you know, where you're not, you know, following an open investigation in a way that is consistent with open investigations. And many other things happened, you know, that are problematic. You know, in terms of the bodies, I mean, they weren't. So how did the bodies? I mean, they were actually just looking to identify the bodies, you know, and to the main purpose of the pent bomb sort of investigation was to, you know, discover, you know, to get as many of the bodies recovered as possible. And to identify as many of the bodies. It was a question of identifying the bodies. That was the main purpose there. It wasn't the question of how they died, because that was already known. So in other words, we're not asking how they died, because we already know that. We just wanted to identify them. Again, that's not, you know, the typical, you know, forensic method that you want.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Indeed. Let me see. We've already briefly discussed the Rainbow Warrior, but the chapter after that is called Smear. What kind of operations are we talking about in this case? And maybe you could illustrate with the MH17 incident, for instance.
So crimes. So one of the sort of orienting, gambits of the book is to say that crimes by us are treated differently than crimes by them. And so the and this is a long way of answering the question. The first pivot who is it? You know, before we say what it is, you know, who are we? You know, is this against us, or is it, you know, so is it potentially by an enemy? That's a very, very important part of a sort of a construction of sort of state government and its security. You know, it's a division of the world, you know, basically through these declaratives that identify, you know, these governance events by way of a preference binary. You know, it's a, you know, the national and state, you know, subjects or identities. And this reaches down into the question of sovereign discretion. You know, the sovereign decides when to act, you know, and if it's a friend or a foe, right? And so this is a fundamental thing. And so with MH17, you know, and Geert van de Wild, I think he's written a book on that as well. A very good book. And he sort of unpacks this this question of MH17 in a lot of detail, because it involves a Dutch investigation as well as, you know, there's an Australian interest in it. There was an Australian interest in it. But the question is, who's on the ground to provide, to collect the information? And according to, unfortunately, if you think that it's a crime by them and it needs to be investigated by us, and us includes Ukrainian intelligence, then Ukrainian intelligence is a fine body to discover the evidence on the ground, right? If on the other hand, you're Russian and you think, well, you know, we're also interested in investigating who's responsible for MH17. And so we're not going to trust Ukrainian intelligence on the ground to provide us with the, you know, the initial capture of that evidence. We need other evidence to satisfy us. And then it's a different matter. This is the problem. I think there's not enough skepticism of the ability, capacity, interest of particularly intelligence to act in a information gathering, evidence gathering capacity for a crime like that, even if it is a crime that involves very significant state narratives and interests. I think, and what happens in the result is that, well, we don't really, concludes, it's very difficult to say what actually happened and who's responsible for that, despite all of the activity of the investigators that were involved. It does depend on you know, for something to be a little less politicized, it really depends on those political actors backing off in the first instance. But it's not likely that they're going to back off in the first instance because they've already announced who the guilty party is. And this is the same in 9/11. They already announced who the guilty party is. And then, of course, the information is structured around the existing narrative. Otherwise, it becomes embarrassing for everybody. And then and the interesting thing about national security is an embarrassment tends to be within the bailiwick of national security. So if you're going to embarrass your government greatly or discredit it in a very public and palpable and meaningful way, is that a national security problem? Well, maybe it is, because there are a lot of embarrassing secrets that have been protected by national security. So it's, the first question is who, and then it is what. So, and also the second division of right and wrong follows the division between us and them, right? So, you know, the normative follows the sort of the realpolitik in a sense, right? it's not the other way around. People think it is, you know, people want to believe it is, and liberals, I guess, have the presumption that it is. But I think, you know, if you were listening to somebody like Henry Kissinger, I don't think that would be the idea that's promulgated. Or the idea of that is promulgated according to sort of political science realists.
So at the end of the book, you conclude. Well, no, it's not your conclusion, but it's a quote. You say that it's interesting to observe the conspiracy discourse as an echo or pantomime of the intelligence operation. You refer to Austin Powers, favorite movie of mine back in the day.
Yeah.
What did you mean by this parallel or this echo?
I mean, part of it is that, you know, it is a, you know, I think conspiracy is, I think, an interesting idea. You know, obviously, the whole point of furtive secret intelligence is to, particularly some of the kinetic intelligence, some of the operational intelligence, is to, you know, create these furtive networks that are capable of doing things according to an ideology that is consistent with the national interest, I suppose, right? Or with a version of the national interest. And so there is a, obviously intelligence is very conspiratorial because it involves both secrecy and a furtive organization. On a matter of like interests or like belief, and so in that respect, you know, I mean, it's interesting. I think there was a comment after the Kennedy or around the Kennedy assassination that, you know, those people that are criticizing or questioning the government narrative with respect to the assassination should be, you know, labeled as conspiracists. Because you know, it's a good way of trying to negate their criticism, but it's a pantomime because, I mean, you know, obviously they are doing the same thing. I mean, the security agencies are involved in these kind of furtive networks of engagement, and so you know, and the other thing that's interesting about it in terms of pantomime is that one of the ideas about Austin Powers, you know, which is a really nice one, is that the intelligence, there's two ways of sort of, one, there's a number of ways of sort of characterizing intelligence culturally, I suppose. One of them is that, oh, well, you know, they're bumbling idiots and, you know, but they mean well. So, you know, so it tries to minimize their culpability or their immorality or what have you, right? The other one is, they're dangerous malcontents, you know, and but that's a sort of the lesser narrative and a way of making intelligence seem more familiar, less objectionable, more, you know, palatable is by making a spoof out of it, you know, and making it seem like it's not really very serious. And, you know, and that's also happened with the 9/11 Commission in the sense that they wanted to say that the intelligence community lacked imagination, which is a complete lie and an obvious lie to anybody who follows intelligence. You know, of course they had a huge amount of imagination. There's no scenario that wasn't imagined, including, you know, parts at least of the scenario that was under investigation. And so, yeah, it's a bit of a pantomime. It's almost like, you know, we're spoofing ourselves by saying that other people believe in these networks of conspiracy. Meanwhile, we are, of course, I mean, intelligence is all about these networks of conspiracy in practice. Now, you know, this is the other thing we didn't talk about, but this whole idea of this dark archive, right? So we have such a small glimpse of what actually happens in this world. And, you know, that's deliberately so. And so it's almost impossible to talk about with any kind of authority. The people that may have the most authority to talk about it can't say a thing about it. And, you know, for the rest of the people, they have no access to that dark archive in order to make, you know, educated pronouncement on it. So there's the interesting contradiction. You know, but I don't think that should necessarily restrict people from trying to, you know, provide a few possible narratives about how the thing holds together and works and where it is structured in terms of liberal democracy. You know, because I think it does. I think, you know, nobody has a moratorium on intelligence. So we had this idea of a non-proliferation for nuclear, you know, and it's obviously going the wrong direction right now. But the same idea could apply to intelligence, because after 9/11, there was an enormous growth in intelligence, you know, obviously logically. But prior to that, there was really actually a decline in budgetary growth of intelligence for a little while. And so that's, you know, that's another thing that doesn't really, people don't really talk about as much. They did in the 1970s. There were actually protests about intelligence in the 1970s, but that's no longer the case. I mean, people are not really looking at intelligence as being, you know, a dangerous part of our existence that should be curtailed to some degree. Quite the opposite, it seems. And right now, with all this effort on information war, so the psychological operations that used to be illegal to do on the United States are now being done, you know, quite legally. So these blowback campaigns or these actually false blowback campaigns are happening, so that, you know, the buildup to the Ukraine situation was very long in terms of the budget of intelligence and information operations that are taking place. So yeah, there's a big buildup, and it's not necessarily very good for liberal democracy.
Thank you for that. I think we can conclude on that note. We've taken quite a peek into your book. So thanks for all the great stories. Maybe a final question. So before the show, you mentioned that you are have an upcoming, or that you have a book contract, a new one. Can you tell us anything about the subject?
Yeah, a bit more of the same. So I want to look at some of the sort of principles of security intelligence, and then look at some of those sort of popular narratives, how intelligence is presented in various media. So we know that, you know, with popular fiction, there's lots of sort of, there are some classic tropes, and I think, you know, the spy who shagged me, the James Bond, you know, are these classic tropes of intelligence. And what do they actually mean? How do they get configured? What does that do for our sort of understanding of or expectation of intelligence? But I also want to think more a little bit about some of these a priori's, you know, that we have this argument that we have to have intelligence, which is more or less a righteous necessity argument. And, you know, how do you unpack that righteous necessity argument? And, you know, where does it come from? Partly it comes from, you know, people like Schmidt, Carl Schmitt, who was very, very, very good analyst of the state, you know, and in the relationship of the sovereign to, you know, particularly parliamentary democracy. And so, you know, I wanted to explore a little bit about that. You know, and of course, the relationship between the normative and legal versus the sort of sovereignty discourse, and why it has to be the sovereign has to be always the primary and the prior and essential or dominant in that couplet. And of course, you know, it's understood that it has to be, and so that intelligence takes a lot from that sort of liberal democratic understanding. But also, you know, how efficacious is this dark action and knowledge? You know, I mean, we don't actually know how efficacious it is, but it might be completely non-efficacious, right? How do we know? Because if we're all, you know, hurtling towards doom, then it can't be argued that, you know, the intelligence community is very efficacious in its use of dark action and knowledge. You know, I suppose because it would be, you know, part of the instrument that's hurtling us towards doom. And I'm not sure that it isn't, you know. You know, and it's also the idea of, you know, when intelligence should be just building the archive and when it should be spending some of its resources in some kind of kinetic action. You know, so how much do you have to save, you know, before you reap? or how much do you have to sow before you reap or whatever. Right? So that whole dynamic there is interesting because the CIA is and Mossad and Israeli intelligence. I mean, they're both very good acting, actors out in the field as well as collecting all sorts of information. So it's not only just dead information that's waiting for a time to be used. It's the question of the timing and how often can you dip into the well, and that sort of thing is interesting as well. And the other thing is about institutional autonomy, how much institutional autonomy is enough, so these are some of the themes that I want to take up in a sort of a follow-up account for Edwin Elgar. I get to it.
Great. We've got something to look forward to. Thanks once again for your time. I wish you all the best, William.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me on.